Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Helper.
I'm Mary Matte. Thanks so much for being here. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get bonus content.
And today's interview is really excellent. It's with Brian Berletic, and he has a fascinating analysis of what motivates Donald Trump when it comes to USAID and also things like the tariff. So definitely excited for people to hear that.
All right, let's get to our four basic food groups. What do we have for Democrats suck?
So for Democrats suck, we have a great example of Democrats basically sucking in their response to things. They always manage to focus on the wrong thing when they're trying to take on Trump. And there is something, you know, I think lots of people talked about Trump being an existential threat at moments when he wasn't. But certain things that are happening are really, really quite worrisome. For instance, Elon Musk's Doge trying to basically take over the Treasury. They have access to federal workforces, personal data. And the way that the Democrats are responding to this isn't by talking about how this is kind of a constitutional crisis because it affects the balance of powers. They're focusing on the fact that it will affect USAID. And they're trying to come up with clever slogans. So let's take a look at how Chuck Schumer is framing this.
So today, Leader Jeffries and I are joining together to push legislation to prevent unlawful meddling in the Treasury Department's payment systems and protect Americans across the country. Our bill aims to do a few simple things. One, to deny access to special government employees that don't have to disclose their conflicts of interest or any other ethic agreements. Two, to deny access to anyone with conflicts of interest or lack of appropriate clearance. And three, include personal tax information into existing privacy protections. We call our legislation Stop the Steal.
So funny, hilarious. Very good delivery by Chuck Schumer. And here's another totally pointless piece of resistance in which Chuck Schumer is engaging. Let's listen to this exciting chant.
Win this fight, and we will win.
We will win.
We will win. We will win. We will win. We will win.
We will win.
We won't rest. We won't rest. We won't rest. We won't rest.
Okay. So that's Chuck Schumer. Now I want to show how Indivisible co-founder Ezra Levin responded to Schumer and his chanting.
I'm going to talk about one man. He was here earlier. He left a little bit earlier, but I have a message for him. Leader Schumer, you were here. You yes. Led some good chants. I like to hear those chants.
Do something.
Do something.
Yes.
Do something.
Do something! Do something! Do something!
I've heard another chant here a few times tonight. I've heard it a few times. Shut down the Senate!
Shut down the Senate! Shut down the Senate!
That's an example of organizers urging the Democrats to offer a more drastic, effective, and serious response to what Elon Musk and Trump are trying to do. But you know what the response of the Democrats reminds me of? It reminds me of how they responded to the killing of George Floyd. Let's take a look at this. Now, people may remember how the Democrats engaged in a totally meaningless, very optics-heavy gesture. They got on one knee and they wore kente cloths. And, you know, I bring this up because it's another example of Democrats doing something performative but not actually getting anything useful done. Because it turned out that, you know, under Joe Biden, the police killings went up. There was increased funding. So none of the things that were being demanded at these George Floyd protests were actually implemented, except no-knock warrants. There was that. But most of the big ones weren't implemented. So, again, this is just yet another example of the Democrats engaging in performance, not anything of substance. And yeah, I'll dress up and no action.
I just have a hard time believing Chuck Schumer when he says that we won't rest.
I mean,
Chuck, you're resting, sir. I mean, you know, I can see him saying, oh, my back, I have to rest, you know, and then being out of commission for a couple of days. So I just don't, Yeah, he's not the most inspiring protest leader. He doesn't evoke, you know, Dr. King or Malcolm X or Fred Hampton or all the many wonderful leaders of resistances that we've had over the years. And now we got Chuck Schumer.
Right. Yes. And look, he couldn't even get through the chant without taking a rest.
Yeah, he had to grab onto Maxine Waters' hand for support. But
the Democrats focus on USAID. It's a serious issue, but it's not one that will resonate with Trump supporters. Whereas if they actually frame this in a way to appeal to not just libertarians, but people who just believe in like in digital privacy, that would be a much more effective framing, rhetorical framing. And then, of course, if they did something more serious, like shut down the Senate, that would be a much more effective actual response.
All right, let's turn to Republicans suck and the fallout from Trump's vision for Gaza, where he declared, in a surprise to many people, including some of his own aides, apparently, that the U.S. is going to take control of Gaza and rebuild it, he says, make a Riviera on the Middle East, not allow Palestinians to return. That was the subtext of his message, that they can go live somewhere else. And he'll bring in people from around the world to basically act as servants for the ultra elite who will now live on the shores of Gaza. Now, Trump didn't get a very good response to this, including from members of his own party, who realized that, especially after a guy who campaigned on ending endless wars, calling for occupying Gaza and taking it over is not exactly a winning message. So Trump is now trying to...
So much for isolationism.
Yeah. And so Trump is trying to now sort of contain the fallout. His aides say he didn't mean it literally, that the U.S. was going to occupy Gaza and take it over. But Trump is still, you know, he's a stubborn guy. He's still standing by his message. So this is his latest effort at damage control. The Gaza Strip would be turned over to the U.S. by Israel at the conclusion of fighting. The Palestinians, people like Chuck Schumer, and what Trump is doing there is he's throwing in one of his favorite insults of Chuck Schumer by saying he's a Palestinian, which is, haha, so funny, because that's supposed to be an insult to be like a Palestinian. And Chuck Schumer is such a Palestinian lover that he is a Palestinian in Trump's, you know, racist framing. Right. The Palestinians would already have been resettled in far safer and more beautiful communities with new and modern homes in the region. They would actually have a chance to be happy, safe, and free. The U.S., working with great development teams from all over the world, would slowly and carefully begin the construction of what would become one of the greatest, most spectacular developments of its kind on Earth. No soldiers by the U.S. would be needed. Stability for the region would reign. Okay, so first of all, now he's talking all in conditional terms, like this would happen, that would happen. He's also saying that we wouldn't even need U.S. soldiers. So what I'm hearing from him now is that basically Israel is going to keep destroying Gaza. And after all that's done, what he calls the fighting, then the U.S. would take it over after Gaza, I guess, has been totally flattened on top of all the destruction that's already happened already. Right. So it looks like Trump is walking away from his plan while still trying to cling to this future vision he has of the U.S. taking over Gaza. It's very, very confusing. And his lackeys, his acolytes in the media, are having a hard time still defending it. But here is Sean Hannity of Fox News doing his best effort.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too.
Now, like Trump's tariff threats and tough negotiations with Panama, Venezuela, Denmark, Mexico, Canada, this is likely just the first chapter in a complex, ongoing art of the deal negotiation. But once again, for the millionth time, the Democratic Party is just overcome with hysteria. You decide.
Well, what's funny is to say that this is a Democratic Party hysteria is funny, because even Republican senators like Lindsey Graham have distanced themselves from Trump's plan. Like, even Lindsey Graham has said, yeah, we're not going to occupy Gaza. We're not going to send boots on the ground there. That wouldn't be very popular. Even Lindsey Graham, the most devoted, or one of the most devoted warmongers there is walking away from this. So it's not even Democratic Party hysteria. And this idea that Trump's just putting out this idea and it's just like it's an opening salvo in a complex negotiation, it's just so funny. No, Trump's calling for the U.S. to occupy Gaza and to take it over. And he really expected people, I think, to go along with it. Oh, people would say, oh, wow, Trump, that's such a brilliant idea. Yes, Palestinians should all just pack up and leave. As we talk about extensively on this week's Thursday Throwdown, which you can get at usefulidiotspodcast.com, there is a solution already on the table in the region. It's called the Arab Peace Initiative. Israel's been offered it for a very long time. All the Arab states, joined by even Iran, have said that Israel can have full normalization if they simply end the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Let the Palestinians create a state there. That's the solution on the table. And that's a solution that the whole world supports, except for the U.S. and Israel. And so Trump trying to think outside the box is just the latest U.S. effort to undermine the solution that's already on the table that pretty much everybody else supports.
Yeah, and not to give anything away, because people should definitely watch Thursday Throwdown, but Aaron, you make a prediction about Trump, what he's going to do. And I kind of think that, you know, we often try to deduce through analysis and exegesis, we try to deduce who watches our show. And I think the fact that Trump is backtracking may have to do with the prediction that you made on Thursday Throwdown. So I think not only does Trump watch Useful Idiots, but I think he's a subscriber to Thursday Throwdown. So for Isn't That Weird, let's take a look at an interesting, aka weird, exchange between a reporter and Donald Trump.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
As our expectation from you, do you have any plan to change Afghanistan's situation? Are you able to recognize Taliban? Because I'm an Afghan journalist, Afghan suffered woman. Any comment about Afghanistan? What's your future plan for Afghan people, especially Afghan?
I have a little hard time understanding you. Where are you from?
Afghanistan.
Actually, it's a beautiful voice and a beautiful accent. The only problem is I can't understand a word you're saying. But I just say this, good luck, live in peace. Go ahead, please.
So that is such a great Trumpian response. Kind of shoots from the hip, makes a joke, says something kind of offensive, admits he can't understand a word she's saying, and then says, go with peace and good luck.
Yeah, Trump's been pretty quiet about Afghanistan recently. He touted this grand plan to withdraw from Afghanistan, but didn't execute by the time he left office the first time. Then Biden did it. And then Trump criticized Biden for the way it was carried out. And fair enough, but because it was deadly and shambolic. But then Trump said we should have actually kept Bagram Air Base. So it turns out that Trump wasn't even fully behind the Afghan withdrawal that he previously was promoting. And now what's he got to say to the people of Afghanistan? Good luck and live in peace. While, of course, we're still maintaining economic restrictions on Afghanistan that make it very hard to recover.
And what do we have for Isn't That Terrible?
For Isn't That Terrible, there's been a lot of gloating this week from the Harris campaign and Kamala Harris supporters after Trump announced his ethnic cleansing vision for Gaza. And people who are on the Harris campaign or supporters of it were taunting Palestinian supporters by saying, you know, how's your uncommitted vote now? Are you happy with what you got? Elections have consequences, as if Kamala Harris's support for the genocide doesn't have consequences as well, including losing the election because she refused to differentiate herself from Joe Biden. And now we get more revelations about what was going on inside the Harris campaign. This is from NBC News about how the Harris campaign was handling voter outrage over Biden's support for the genocide in Gaza. A Harris organizer who worked on youth turnout said that senior campaign officials gave them an order when they sent out mass volunteer or fundraising emails and people replied by asking about Gaza. They were told to mark it as no response. The result, they seldom ended up engaging with voters on that issue. And the article goes on to say that when there was a list of issues that people were given the choice of ticking when it comes to their concerns with the Harris campaign, they refused to even put Gaza as an issue because they didn't want that to leak out to the media. So that was the Harris campaign response to voter outrage about Gaza, which is pretend it doesn't exist. And that helped lead to their defeat. And now they turn around and with Trump announcing this dumb vision of the U.S. taking over Gaza, them gloating when, again, they were the ones actively fueling a genocide and refusing to do anything about it to the point where they wouldn't even acknowledge the concerns of voters who were upset about it.
Right. Like the only reason Trump can make the announcement he's making is because it's in the context of a fallout from a genocide that the Biden administration enabled.
Exactly. And here's a bonus. Isn't That Terrible? This group Beitar, a fanatic supporter of the Israeli government, has been going around and putting pagers in the pockets of people who support Palestinian rights. Among them, Norman Finkelstein, a frequent guest on this show, leading critic of the Israeli government, scholar on this issue. And here's footage of them finding Norman Finkelstein on the street and putting a pager in his pocket.
And of course, the pager is a reference to Israel's terrorist attack on Lebanon when they detonated pagers that were on Hezbollah people. And of course, that meant included killing people who were total civilians that had nothing to do with Hezbollah.
You a pager. You want a pager, Norman?
Jews were known for being smart.
And there
you go. Where's your pager, Norman?
You know what?
It's fucking Holocaust denial, you piece of shit.
So there they are harassing Norman Finkelstein, putting a pager in his pocket and calling him names and calling him a Holocaust denier, someone whose parents survived the Nazi genocide and the rest of their family was wiped out. So that's the level of shame of these people.
Someone whose parents were in multiple concentration camps and lost. Yeah, just absolutely disgusting.
They're not alone in doing this. Netanyahu at the White House, when he visited Trump, also handed him a pager. As I guess a nice little joke. Here's a picture. There it is. Ha ha ha. You know, these pagers that injured and maimed Lebanese civilians, including children.
And killed.
Now it's just a big joke for these people.
Yeah. Hilarious. Well, that has been your four basic food groups. Ever wonder how much of your personal data is out there on the internet for anyone to see? More than you think. Your name, contact info, social security number, home address, even information about your family members can all be compiled by data brokers and sold online. For us at Useful Idiots, with our reporting and opinions being made public every week, we're hyper aware of safety and security. And it's easier than ever to find personal information about people online. That's why we personally recommend DeleteMe. DeleteMe is a subscription service that removes your personal info from hundreds of data brokers. To put it simply, DeleteMe does all the hard work of wiping your and your family's personal information from data broker websites. And they're not just a one-time service. DeleteMe is always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. Sign up and provide DeleteMe with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe. Now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan by texting IDIOTS to 64000. Text IDIOTS to 64000. That's IDIOTS to 64000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details.
It's a new year. We've got a new administration. And with the way things are changing, it's getting harder and harder to predict what the world will look like even tomorrow, which is why we searched the whole world to find one thing that we can dependently rely on. And we found it at American Giant. They're making high quality, long lasting clothes that never go out of style. As presidents come and go, as years go by, and as seasons change, your clothes won't have to. Born from a commitment to support the communities that create its products, every American Giant piece is made in America and designed to last. No exceptions. American Giant makes staples that are anything but basic. Try their classic full zip hoodie, which Slate magazine called the greatest hoodie ever made. You can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Or the premium Slub Crew Tee, no BS high-rise pant, and slim roughneck pant featured in Giant magazine issue 2. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. For this week's guest, we are joined by Brian Berletic. He is a former U.S. Marine focused on geopolitics in Eurasia. He has a very informative YouTube channel. It's called The New Atlas. And in this interview, we're going to speak to Brian about many topics: the war in Ukraine, China, Trump's plans for the Panama Canal. But first, we discuss the targeting of USAID led by Elon Musk and what is really going on. So this is Brian Berletic.
Welcome, Brian Berletic.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's an honor and a pleasure to join both of you.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Well, we feel the same way. And we wanted to start off by asking you about your thoughts on USAID. You have a tweet that's very helpful. You say, no, the Trump admin isn't dismantling USAID. USAID is now directly under U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who spent years as part of the USAID-NED regime change complex advancing U.S. aggression and political capture abroad. Before Rubio became Secretary of State, he was on the NED-USAID subsidiary IRI's board of directors, doing the very things people mistakenly believe he and the Trump administration will stop. So can you elaborate on this, both on the way that people are misunderstanding the news and what the news actually is?
Yes, well, I can't blame people for misunderstanding what is going on, because both sides of the American political aisle, they're deliberately lying to the public. So on the so-called left side, they're lying about what USAID does. There's posing as if it is some sort of humanitarian organization helping people all around the globe. And if you listen to the actual Trump administration, what they're saying, the things that they are citing that need to be brought to an end, they're talking about DEI, they're talking about transgender art performances. They have not mentioned foreign interference, regime change, subversion, stifling development, despite the word development being in the organization's name. They haven't mentioned any of that, and they have not said that they are going to stop any of that. And if people look at the State Department's official website and the statement about USAID, they even say that they just want to make sure that it is helping advance American interests abroad. They didn't say that they're done interfering abroad. They just want to make sure everything is being channeled into American, I would say, interference abroad. I'm almost certain this is going to continue, if not under USAID, under some other organization that assumes its responsibilities.
And can you give some examples of what USAID actually does?
Yeah, so there's a few areas of responsibility, I guess you could say, they handle. A lot of people are talking about regime change, and that is absolutely one of their activities that they're involved in. So there are opposition groups that the U.S. builds up in targeted nations. They're not just building up political opposition, they are building a whole parallel system next to the indigenous institutions of a targeted nation. And the goal is to reach a critical mass where a color revolution can then remove the existing government and replace it with this parallel organization that they have created. So USAID is spending money side by side with the National Endowment for Democracy, all of its subsidiaries, all of the adjacent private foundations that work hand in hand with all of these U.S. government organizations. So that is one thing that they do. Another thing that they do is participate in counterinsurgency. And before we began, I showed you a U.S. government counterinsurgency manual. And they have a whole section about USAID and how it is used as a tool in counterinsurgency. What is counterinsurgency? What are they talking about? They're talking about when the U.S. military goes into a nation like Iraq or Afghanistan, they remove a government from power and they install a client regime in its place. The people there rising up against it. And here is a photo. So just think about how tone deaf or brazen they are to post this picture. This is a picture of the Philippines. The U.S. conquered the Philippines. They stripped it from Spain after the Spanish-American War. There was an uprising because they wanted to be an independent nation. The U.S. military brutally suppressed it. Mass murder, concentration camps. This is all listed on the State Department's website, by the way. And so they're talking about insurgency, counterinsurgency, and USAID's role in the counterinsurgency process. So that is the second area of responsibility USAID participates in. And the third is stifling development. So I've covered this a lot here in Southeast Asia. One of the U.S. government's obsessions here is the Mekong River. The Mekong River is on the other side of the planet from the United States. It has nothing to do with the U.S., has nothing to do with Japan or Australia, who often work with the U.S., to involve themselves in the Mekong. And what they're doing is telling nations along the Mekong River, you're not building dams, you're not developing industry along it. We're going to maintain these impoverished villages where they are fishing fish in the river to extinction, and we're going to keep it that way. And so the goal is to stop development within these nations, development together as a region, and develop development between the region and especially China. So that these are the three main areas that USAID focuses on, which is an irony because, like I said, the left is claiming it's a humanitarian organization, and the Trump administration right now is trying to make it out as if it's this liberal, it's spreading liberal values around the globe. But what it is a tool of political capture that has been used for decades, regardless of who's in the White House, regardless who controls Congress.
Why do you expect that the Trump administration is not going to go after the regime change, destabilization components of USAID and just focused on the relatively trivial stuff like, you know, their role in whatever they can define as woke programs, things to do with, you know, transgender issues, things like that, but not destabilizing countries?
Because President Trump himself, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, I mean, they're laying out their foreign policy right now. And they're talking about seizing the Panama Canal, seizing Greenland, regime change in Iran. North Korea is a rogue state. We need to compete with China. We need to contain China. How do you do that? What are the tools the United States has to do that? Are they going to compete with China by building infrastructure? No. USAID and organizations like it that go out and cause chaos, that knock down everything China and other nations are trying to build up, that is the only tool set that they actually have. And they are telling the American people that this is going to be their foreign policy. So, of course, they're not going to get rid of the most effective tools they have to do this. They're just going to streamline them and sharpen them.
But the counterargument would be in a place like Ukraine, where we've already seen complaints that all these media outlets that were supported by the U.S. have now been forced to curtail the operations or shut down. There was some figure like 90% of what's described as independent media in Ukraine is funded by the U.S. government via USAID. I'm not sure if that figure is accurate, but certainly there is a large percentage of these outlets in Ukraine that have been funded by the U.S. and they are complaining about how they're losing money. So the argument there would be this is a form of U.S. power. This is you being used to advance U.S. interests in the proxy war there. So here's Trump putting a freeze on their funding. That's an example of Trump taking on the so-called deep state.
Well, we have to wait and see if that's what actually happens. I don't think people understand these news platforms, these fake NGOs. They're not getting funded daily by USAID. They get money per month, sometimes per quarter, sometimes annual grants. And so it's not as if there's like money like instantly coming in into their hands all day, every day. And now it's just been shut off like the water or the electricity. This is something that they'll have to wait a month, a quarter, or even a year to actually feel the effect of. And Secretary Rubio himself has said that they're going to review this. A lot of the programs that were frozen are already being funded again. There will be waivers, partial waivers. So if people actually listen to what the Trump administration itself is saying, they're not saying that this is permanent. They're reviewing it. There's undoubtedly going to be programs that are cut because it is bloated and there is a huge amount of corruption. We saw that, say, in Afghanistan. In hindsight, we could see how much corruption there was there. If they could cut that and continue doing these type of activities, they will. And I'm almost certain that's what we will see. And if they do completely eliminate USAID, they will just replace it with something else. Because USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy, all of these organizations have been created and reformed and rebranded over many, many years. As people become aware of them, as targeted governments learn how to defend themselves against it, the U.S. itself adapts to this and changes their tactics, changes their tool sets.
Yeah, like one tell here is that people like Elon Musk keep talking about they're going after the radical left, yeah. USAID, the radical left NED, when in fact the NED and USAID have long been used to go after what these same people call radical left states like Venezuela and Cuba. Like that's been their raison d'etre for so long. But yet now the same people supposedly dismantling USAID and the NED are calling them radical left, which doesn't really make sense because these groups are used to undermine governments that don't obey orders and therefore are called radical left.
Absolutely. And Elon Musk himself was using X to promote U.S.-backed regime change in Venezuela. I don't remember exactly when that was, but it was relatively recently. And how does he think this was being achieved? What tools, what vectors was the U.S. using to implement attempted regime change in Venezuela? Of course, it's USAID, National Endowment for Democracy. All of these organizations that they're calling radical left were the ones they were using to, as you say, eliminate radical left government. So it is absurd. For people that are actually listening objectively, they will see that none of this actually adds up.
Related to the idea that people on the left and the right are falling for certain anti-deep state disruptive narratives, let's take a look at this video of Marco Rubio talking to Megyn Kelly. And a lot of people were very excited about what he said here.
I think we spend a lot of time in American politics debating tactics, like what we're going to do, who we're going to sanction, what letter we're going to send or whatever. I think it really has to start with strategy. What is the strategic objective? What's the purpose, the mission? And I think the mission of American foreign policy, and this may sound sort of obvious, but I think it's been lost. The interest of American foreign policy is to further the national interest of the United States of America, right?
I mean, America every first. Well,
and that's the way the world has always worked. The way the world has always worked is that the Chinese will do what's in the best interest of China. The Russians will do what's in the best interest of Russia. You know, the Chileans are going to do what's in the best interest of Chile. And the United States needs to do what's in the best interest of the United States. Where our interests align, that's where you have partnerships and alliances. Where our differences are not aligned, that is where the job of diplomacy is to prevent conflict while still furthering our national interest and understanding they're going to further theirs. And that's been lost. And I think that was lost at the end of the Cold War because we were the only power in the world. And so we assume this responsibility of sort of becoming the global government in many cases, trying to solve every problem. And there are terrible things happening in the world. There are. And then there are things that are terrible that impact our national interest directly. And we need to prioritize those again. So it's not normal for the world to simply have a unipolar power. That was an anomaly. It was the product of the end of the Cold War. But eventually you were going to reach back to a point where you had a multipolar world, great powers in different parts of the planet. We face that now with China and to some extent, you know, Russia. And then you have rogue states like Iran and North Korea you have to deal with. So now more than ever, we need to remember that foreign policy should always be about furthering the national interest of the United States and doing so to the extent possible, avoiding war and armed conflict, which we have seen two times in the last century.
Okay, so a lot of people were very optimistic about this. They read into it that he was kind of championing a multipolar world, suggesting that there would be diplomacy, not war. What are your thoughts on this?
That's not my takeaway. My takeaway was, first of all, people have to understand when he's talking about being the world police, as if America was doing this out of the goodness of its own heart, it has been doing this to impose a U.S.-led unipolar world order upon the entire planet. That was the whole purpose of it. It's not working anymore because the world is multipolar. So him acknowledging reality, I guess that is a step in the right direction, but that's all he's doing is acknowledging reality. What is America's interest? Does he ever explain what American interests are? Not really. And then he spends the rest of the interview talking about, again, seizing the Panama Canal because of China, seizing Greenland because of China. So he has this obsession with China. And at the end of the day, what does that mean? And what are all the foreign policies that they are preparing, that they have inherited from the Biden administration and plan on continuing? They all surround confronting China, and not just confronting China, but doing it off China's own shores, doing it on the island province of Taiwan, doing it in the Philippines, in Japan, in South Korea, and continuing to undermine China's Belt and Road Initiative around the globe. And so how is that a step in the right direction? Aside from recognizing that America's power is limited, they have to acknowledge that they can't just kick over these countries anymore. Beyond that, I really don't see it as a step in the right direction.
Another area where you are concerned that people are kind of falling for their ideological team is with tariffs. And there's a lot of celebration of these tariffs as, celebration and condemnation. Again, we see it from both sides. So one side is praising it as MAGA. MAGA tariffs, and the other side is condemning it as MAGA tariffs. you see the continuity in tariff policy. So can you talk about that and how it is evolved or not evolved between from Biden to Trump?
Well, this goes to show how blinding ideology can really be. The tariffs began, the trade war began under the first Trump administration, but then the Biden administration continued every single tariff that was put in place under the Trump administration, and then he began expanding on it for the exact same reasons the first Trump administration did. So was Biden a secret America First candidate? I don't think so. And then the Biden administration has handed it back over to another Trump administration, which is continuing everything the Biden administration was doing. So what is this really about? This isn't about America First. This is about decoupling from China. It's no secret that America depends on Chinese industry. If the U.S. were to go to war with China right now, they would be basically going to war with their own imports. All their imports are coming from China. So they have to decouple first to try to soften that blow. We look at what happened to Europe and the sanctions on Russia and how that has affected Europe economically, socially, politically. The U.S. understands that this is going to be even worse in any potential conflict with China. So they're doing the decoupling now. If you read the think tank documents over many, many years, this is all they talk about, is decoupling ahead of war with China. It's essential. It's a prerequisite before going to war with China. So you see the U.S. taking steps to prepare for war with China. And one of these steps is decoupling. And how do you decouple? With tariffs. And for American businesses, you know, there is going to be a price to pay for the tariffs, but who's ultimately going to pay the price? It's going to be consumers. So you have all these people clapping for the tariffs and America First, but they're the ones that are going to be paying for it. It's going to be in the form of a cost of living crisis that's already underway, and it's going to only get worse. I haven't heard anyone talk about how they're going to address that. I always hear people saying, well, no, this is about reindustrializing the U.S., but in order to reindustrialize the U.S., you'd have to completely reform education, and you would also have to completely rethink how you're going to deal with infrastructure and invest heavily in infrastructure. No one's even talking about doing that, let alone taking any steps toward actually doing it.
Going back to USAID for a second, I just remembered one thing that I think you'll find funny. So USAID, NED fund groups like Bellingcat, right, which call themselves open source outlets, but they often end up parroting US government propaganda against states that are targeted for regime change, like in Syria. And I have my own encounters with them because of the Syria chemical weapons issue. And then what I was amazed to see was that after Bellingcat got a lot of criticism for taking money from the National Endowment for Democracy, they stopped doing that. And then you look at the next year on their donor sheet, and it's no longer the NED. It's a firm called Chemonix, which receives contracts from the U.S. government, including from USAID. So all they did was, like, rather than directly funding groups via USAID and the NED, they just told their military contractors who profit off of the regime change wars to fund their same operations. And I just suspect we might be seeing similar machinations to get around the fact that, you know, the USAID brand right now is tainted. I forgot to mention that earlier. And, you know, Brian, you have experience with groups like this because so-called open source researchers are often, you know, criticizing people like yourself who do similar kind of work, but because you're challenging U.S. government, Western government narratives, you're not considered legitimately open source.
Yeah, no, this is a very good point. And actually, this is essential to understand. For years, the U.S. Regime change and foreign interference complex has been in transition. They understand that more and more people are waking up to it. People are waking up to what the NED does, what USAID do. They are beginning to understand it. Governments around the world are starting to take action to defend against it. And so the most recent example was Georgia trying to pass foreign agent laws to deal with this. And what they're worried about is a cascade of nations passing these type of laws and securing their political and their information space from U.S. interference, which has spread with impunity for decades and decades. And so very, very subtly, year by year, they're doing exactly like what you've said. People know that the NED is funding them. It taints them. The U.S. government being involved taints the entire movement. So the U.S. government has been depending more and more on private foundations. You had Open Society. They have become notorious and infamous and well-known. So then they started moving to Omidyar, and then they started moving to basically a shell game where this one is getting money from this one, until, you know, it comes back to USAID, the NED, or the State Department itself. So this is what they've been doing. I know this because when I see unrest and I'm trying to track the funding, this is the wild goose chase that I go on, trying to find where the money is coming from. Ahead of the Arab Spring, years before the Arab Spring began, the U.S. was training those activists that led it. The State Department, it was called youthmovements.org. And this was a State Department project in coordination with U.S. media companies, and they were training and equipping and funding these basically agitators to go back to their respective countries and overthrow them. Well, then it became known that this is what the U.S. did. The New York Times even had to write an entire article about how this was what actually happened. And so what did they do? They got rid of that organization and replaced it with the Oslo Freedom Forum. If you look at the Oslo Freedom Forum, they'll have something like the Freedom Fund funding them. Then you have to go to the Freedom Fund's webpage, and that's when you find out that it's still the State Department funding them, but they're doing it through, you know, they're removing it degrees of separation to try to create the illusion of plausible deniability, hoping that people don't look into it, or that at least people like us trying to expose it makes it seem more convoluted, even though it really isn't, and it puts a little bit more doubt in the audience's mind about what's actually really happening. So you have it's a well-founded fear. I'm pretty sure that that's what they're doing. They're just rebranding it. They're sharpening it. They're streamlining it. They're definitely not going to do away with it, because they're telling you their foreign policy, and it depends entirely on a tool like this.
The example you raise of Georgia is so important, because it recently emerged that USAID spent more than $40 million on Georgia's elections. $40 million. Compare that to the freakout in the U.S. over allegations that a Russian troll farm spent $100,000 in the 2016 election, when in fact the reality was it was about $46,000, but whatever, even if it was $100,000. So a Russian troll farm spent $46,000 on social media posts and ads that nobody saw and that weren't even about the election, most of them. And there was just a national freakout for years during Russiagate. This was blamed as the cause of Trump's victory, or as a major factor in Trump's victory. Whereas we spend $40 million on Georgia's elections, and that's considered to be totally normal. And in terms of all these different shady groups that like act as a cover for the U.S. government, I personally experienced this a few years ago when The Guardian declared that I am the most prolific spreader of disinformation on Syria. And they don't give an example of my alleged disinformation, but you look at the source, it's a study from a group called the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. And who are their funders? It's all these U.S. government agencies, including the Department of State, other NATO governments, and a Pierre Omidyar foundation called Luminate that nobody had ever heard of before. So that's just how it's done. To spread disinformation, they pass it around and they spread it out, and they get all these different, you know, benign sounding groups like Luminate. Like, what is that? What's wrong with Luminate? And it turned out it's just the foundation of a billionaire oligarch doing the bidding of the U.S. government.
Yes, absolutely. And I've gone through the exact same process. There are organizations attacking me, also going as far as claiming that I'm some sort of Russian or Chinese agent, when they themselves, the people attacking me, you can go to their website and you can look through their bio, and they themselves will admit that they're receiving all kinds of U.S. government money. And you know, the thing that doesn't add up
is projecting, I think, you know, they're like on the take, so they're assuming that other people are.
And the craziest thing is they're trying to convince people that they stand for human rights and democracy and freedom, and they're taking money from the absolute worst violator of human rights this 21st century. No one else comes even close. Even the things the U.S. makes up about China that aren't even true, but let's just pretend for a minute they were true, it pales in comparison to what the U.S. has openly done in front of the entire planet. all throughout the 21st century. And that's who they're taking money from. And then they'll say, Brian, the National Endowment for Democracy has got the word democracy in its name. What's wrong with that? It says democracy. You hate democracy? And I tell them, look at the board of directors. You have Elliot Abrams is a convicted criminal. He's on the board of directors. You have people like Scott Carpenter who participated in the illegal occupation and illegal administration of Iraq. I mean, that's who you're taking money from. And so it is immense hypocrisy. I believe that it's unsustainable. And I think as multipolarism emerges, as a balance of power begins to grow, they're not going to be able to get away with this. They're not going to enjoy the impunity that they have almost certainly had all of these decades. They got away with it because there was no one else able to check and balance them. Now that there is, or soon will be, they have to start taking that into account. And I think that's all Secretary Rubio was talking about when he was talking about a unipolar world. They're worried about comeuppance, maybe. They're worried at least that they're going to have to change their tactics and the impunity that they've enjoyed for so long is over.
So just like USAID, there's some excitement that Trump is going to now remake the CIA because of news that him and Elon Musk are offering buyouts to many CIA employees. And that's fueling hope that, oh, well, now Trump's really taking on the deep state. The CIA is going to be different. But, you know, an article about this in the Wall Street Journal then disclosed that the new priority of the CIA is going to be undermining China, which sounds like the same old CIA, just with a focus this time, especially on China. What do you make of that? And what do you think that entails if the CIA's, you know, one of its key roles now will be to try to undermine China as opposed to, say, Russia, which they spent a lot of time and effort on?
It's another case of these are tool sets that the U.S. needs to streamline and sharpen because they understand time is running out. China is on the rise. And the U.S. understands that at a certain point, China is going to irreversibly surpass the collective West, not just the U.S., the collective West, the Chinese economy, the industrial base, the population. In many ways, it's larger than the G7 combined. And so they understand what will happen if it irreversibly surpasses the West. They will never get an opportunity to encircle and contain China again. There will be no conflict that they will be able to fight and win against China at a certain point in the future. And that we're not really sure at what point that is. So they are utterly obsessed with stopping China. This is all they talk about in the think tanks. This is all they talk about, preparing for war with China. How can they multiply their forces? How can they leverage the industrial base of their allies? Because their own industrial base is incapable of challenging and competing with China. That's all they're talking about. So it doesn't surprise me that they're going to cut out everything that they're doing everywhere else to focus solely on China. People have to understand the whole obsession with Russia was because the goal ultimately is to isolate China economically, geographically, militarily. You can't do that if they share this border with Russia and if Russia has a government that is friendly with Beijing. You cannot do that. They have huge amounts of natural resources, including hydrocarbons. If you're conducting a maritime blockade against China everywhere else around the globe, but you cannot cut off hydrocarbons and natural resources flowing in from Russia, then China will still be extremely powerful. So this is why they were obsessed with Russia, but ultimately the primary target has always been China.
Can you talk about the way this prioritization is reflected? I mean, what's interesting is your analysis shows all the ways that the China obsession motivates like every conflict. So can you give some examples of that? I mean, ranging from the tariffs to the proxy war in Ukraine.
Yeah. So, I mean, with Ukraine, it's easy because, if you look at a map, you can see Russia and China, they share a border, and you can see the U.S. is trying to encircle both of them. And so it makes sense that they have expanded NATO all along Russia's border, and Ukraine was the next domino to fall. And if you listen to people at the Atlantic Council, like Damon Wilson, who used to be at the Atlantic Council, now he heads the National Endowment for Democracy, he actually gave a speech where he was talking about how the ultimate goal is to eventually have a free and democratic Russia, which is just a euphemism for a Russia absorbed by the US-led international order. So that was the goal. This is what Russia is reacting to. But ultimately, again, it comes down to China. They write about how they need to isolate China, isolate it, set up choke points. When I heard the Trump administration talking about the Panama Canal and Greenland, I suspected that it was because of shipping lanes. And then if you listen to that interview that Secretary Rubio gave, that is exactly why he said they need to go after the Panama Canal and Greenland, shipping lanes, especially in relation to China. So in many ways, they're now openly starting to say it themselves. I think they feel like they're running out of time. They really don't have the luxury of wearing the mask and trying to dress this all up, which may be a reason why they're trying to reshape something like USAID, because that really is, it serves a very practical function, but a lot of it is also perception management. I think they're done with the perception management, and they want to focus solely on a practical means of encircling and containing China. Just one more example. I'm in Southeast Asia, Thailand. Thailand's neighbor to the west is Myanmar. This is a country that has been ravaged by war since it gained independence from the British Empire after World War II. And this is US-backed militants fighting the central government, and they are openly attacking Chinese Belt and Road Initiative infrastructure, pipelines that are supposed to bring hydrocarbons from Myanmar's coast up to Kunming, China, to allow China to circumvent the Strait of Malacca and the South China Sea, where the US is openly preparing to use its military if there is a conflict to blockade Chinese maritime shipping. And so that is a conflict that is taking place because the US is trying to disrupt the Belt and Road Initiative and encircle and contain China. If they cannot install a obedient client regime in Myanmar or other countries along its periphery, they're happy to settle with just destabilizing these countries and denying them as a functional, constructive trading partner, a defense partner, security partner with China.
So how do you think China responds to all this?
So far they have been extremely patient. I'm certain they know all of this. I'm certain that there's no question as to why their infrastructure is being attacked in, say, Myanmar. They're also doing it in Pakistan. There are regular attacks on Chinese engineers in Balochistan, southwest Pakistan. There was an attempt to kill the Chinese ambassador to Pakistan. I'm pretty sure they know who's behind it. They understand that it was the U.S. behind the protests in Hong Kong. They understand that it's the U.S. behind this separatist movement and the political capture of the Alian province of Taiwan. So they know all of this by right. Taiwan being recognized as Chinese territory under international law. The U.S. has troops there in Taiwan. This has been admitted in recent years. By right, they could go to war over. That is an act of war. You have your troops in somebody else's territory. But they're being patient. I think they feel that their economic power, their constructive ties with the rest of the world, eventually it's going to reach critical mass that nothing the collective West can do will be able to stop it. And so they're trying to manage the decline of U.S. primacy worldwide. And they, along with the Russians, I think, are trying to give the United States many different types of exits to gracefully exit from this without it resorting in conflict. But I feel like maybe that's not the best strategy, because I feel that Washington, ultimately, they're not going to accept a China that surpasses the collective West. They will not accept it, and they'll do almost anything to stop it. So this is the fear.
You said in one of your recent videos that Trump is not going against the deep state. He's going with the deep state. And this is kind of a foundational question, but I do think it's important laying out, what is a deep state? How does it function? How does it represent special interests?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was a fascinating interview with a really great guest. And I highly encourage people to, if they don't already, subscribe to usefulidiotspodcast.com, because in the bonus section of that interview, we get into how Brian's own experience in the military really shaped his view of the world. He had a real rude awakening about how the United States works and how the military work. He also shares his analysis about what is really behind America's treatment of Israel-Palestine, and he gets into what the deep state really means. And I think he's right that a lot of people don't understand how it functions. So he sheds a lot of light on that.
All right. You can get the full interview with Brian Berletic at our website, usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get all kinds of bonus content. Thanks so much for watching. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.